So the thing is that if a microscopic superpotential depends on a coupling lambda, okay? So we think about the lambda, what we were discussing last time. So we think about coupling. So lambda is one of the couplings. And we think of this as lambda is an expectation value. Expectation value of some auxiliary chiral superfield, okay? Chiral superfield, right? And so once we realize that, then we actually have a very powerful constraint, and the constraint is that we know that superpotential W effective can contain only chiral superfields. Okay, so it cannot contain anti-chiral superfields. So if I think of this as an expectation value, right? So I think of this as, instead of lambda, I think of chi, right? Microscopic, some expectation value. Now, whatever quantum corrections are, those quantum corrections, so this is quantum correction. Whatever quantum corrections will be in there, it will be such that the full effective superpotential must not depend on on chi bar. Okay? Because chi bar, if chi is a chiral superfield, chi bar will be an anti-chiral superfield. And so whatever quantum corrections are, our superpotential must be independent of them. But then at this stage, we recall that our expectation value is just a coupling. And so we have a very powerful statement that if our microscopic superpotential depends on lambda, then couplings in the superpotential are complex, then including the full quantum corrections, it must not depend on lambda bar. Okay, so this is a very powerful argument that that forms the basis of the non-randomization theorem, which we're going to study right now, which we're going to discuss right now. So, any questions with this whole idea of thinking about couplings as expectation value of chiral superfield? And then the only thing I will be using is this, actually. And I claim that that's enough to tell you exactly what the full quantum superpotential is. Okay, so we'll work out an explicit example. So our example will be a Vesuvino model. So we'll start with a classical or a microscopic superpotential, which takes this form. Okay. And so we will assume that whatever the full superpotential is, so W effective, it's a function. Well, we still have some superfield, right? So it will be some low energy superfield phi. I'm going to use exactly the same notation. So in principle, this might have nothing to do with the superfield in the microscopic theory. And then it can depend only on lambda and F. It cannot depend on their complex conjugate. It cannot depend on their complex conjugate. So just to emphasize this fact, del lambda bar must equal to zero, and del W effective over del M bar also equals to zero. So the way how we're going to proceed in this example is we're going to ask, what are the symmetries that we have in our system? And we will insist that those symmetries and the supersymmetry is unbroken by quantum corrections. Okay? I can assign two U1 symmetries. One symmetry will be related with I don't know how to, what name to give it. I give it little m. And the other one is a U1 R symmetry. So I have three objects in my microscopic superpotential, one chiral superfield and two couplings. So I will use a standard R charge for phi. I'm going to call it plus one. Then if I make this assignment, m has an R charge zero, and lambda has an R charge minus one, then you can see that the R charge of micro equals to plus two, as it must be. Okay, the R charge of the superpotential must be two. Then this is some auxiliary, a different global symmetry. So this is some global symmetry. That I have to discover on case-by-case basis when I look at the model. And so the symmetry that I have now is a U1 symmetry under which my field 5 has charge plus 1. Then in order to make a superpotential invariant under this symmetry, I have to, let's call this capital G, right? Some global symmetry. It's a global symmetry, so the G charge of micro must be equal to zero. So if I'm going to normalize a global charge of phi, I'm going to say that it is plus one, then I have to assign to M a charge of minus two, and I have to assign to lambda a charge of minus three. Okay? So again, there is no problem, as we discussed last time, of assigning charges to coupling, because we're thinking about those couplings as expectation values of chiral superfields anyway. So any questions up to now? What I did? Okay? Very good. So what I see, I showed you two symmetries, and I will insist that those two symmetries are U1G cross U1R survive quantum corrections. In principle, that is not always the case. Sometimes global symmetries can be broken by quantum correction. That's when we have anomaly. But as a first approximation, what is always people doing is really assuming that there are no anomalies and see where it will lead us. Okay, so the next step, I'm going to say that, well, so this W effective will contain phi, lambda, and m, and I want it to be, in the limit, W effective as lambda goes to zero. So as lambda goes to zero, I'm turning off all the interactions in my model, right? So there is only the first term in the superpotential, but that's just a mass term for my scalars and fermions. So the model is non-interactive. So I'm going to require that as lambda goes to zero, I'm going to go back to my microscopic, or classical, which in this case, classical superpotential. So I'm assuming, which is also a big assumption, that the limit of turning off couplings is smooth. Okay, so one assumption is that the symmetry, global symmetry that I am assigning, will survive quantum corrections, which means that no anomalies. And the other assumption is that limits of vanishing couplings. Couplings are smooth. Okay? Good. So the next step, I want to construct monomials. So I have three objects, phi, m, and lambda, that my effective superpotential can depend on. I don't know what this dependence is, but I'm just going to construct the most general monomials So what we're going to do is construct most general monomials, from phi and lambda, invariant under all global symmetries. You will see in a second why do we need to do this exercise. Okay, so the monomial that I will be looking at, so I'm assuming that it's a monomial, so it will have a form phi to the power n1, m to the power n2, and lambda to the power n3. Okay, so I'm looking at the monomials of this type, and I'm asking how many monomials do I have which are invariant under my symmetry. So what this means is that the R charge here must be equal to zero, and the global charge of this monomial must be equal to zero as well. Now, clearly, this is a trivial exercise to do. Once we know, okay, so I'm going to read this directly here. Right, so. What do I have? So the global charge of phi to the n1, m to the n2, lambda to the n3 is n1 minus 2n2 minus 3n3 must be equal to 0. And the R charge phi to the n1, m to the n2, lambda to the n3. So this gives me n1 minus n3 equals to 0. Okay. So I can solve this. I can solve this linear system of equations. So n3 equals to n1, and n2 equals to the minus n1. Okay. So what we are finding that the invariant monomials are on this side. Okay, so this is invariant combination where n1 is anything with any integer. So any questions at this stage? So it claims that if I insist,
is the R charge supposed to be 2 that you're talking for?
It is for the superpotential. Oh, but the question that we are asking is what are the invariant monomials? Now, I'm going to use the invariant monomials to write down a most general function this W effective can take. That's why it's easier for me to find invariant combination, because I can always choose something that has the right charges to begin with. Yes?
Why do you insist on the one being this combination is invariant?
Right. It's beautiful observation. I don't. So what I said, I will not reply. And in fact, just to emphasize your point, what we are going to do is, I'm just going to write down, actually both of you guys, I'm just going to write down the most general form of W effect. So W effective will have this form, m phi squared, and then there is an arbitrary function by lambda divided by m. So I claim that this must be the this is another function in principle. I will actually restrict in second to integers, but we'll come back to maybe I'll come back to this issue at the end of today's discussion. Okay, for now, clearly, so this is a function of something that's invariant under global symmetry. So this doesn't carry any charges whatsoever. And what I did, I just choose m phi squared, and the charges are such that that provides the correct charges for the superpotential. So, so this function, the only thing I know about this function f of z is that it is a holomorphic function. So it's an arbitrary holomorphic function, right? Z is a complex variable, so it's a holomorphic function of a single complex variable, but it's an arbitrary function. Now, the question that was asked, why do I have to restrict to integer powers? And that's related to the question, what are there any restrictions on this holomorphic function? So the thing is that the way how Zeigler and Witten solved the NFO2 supersymmetric Young-Yield theory is that they have been able to figure out, okay, so let me just mention one thing. So suppose I have a complex plane, okay? So suppose I have a complex plane Z, and I know that on this plane, I define a holomorphic function. A holomorphic function can have different type of singularities. Okay? So it can have poles. It also can have a branch points. So in particular, if I would have a fractional powers of Z, that would be branch points. Or it can have essential singularity, right? Essential singularity. For each model that we talk about, we have to use physics in order to figure out or argue what is the singularity structure, of my function. The beauty of the holomorphic functions is that if you tell me that on this plane there, the function is regular everywhere except at finite number of points, and you can tell me what type of singularity is, for example, this is a logarithmic singularity, right? So this is like a branch point of an infinite order. This is a pole singularity. And you tell me the order of the pole. I will tell you very often uniquely what the function is. So the nice thing about holomorphic functions is that the holomorphic functions is determined by by singularity properties. Okay. So in order for me to be precise, so I need to know, and in order for me to determine the function, I need to know this function on a Riemann sphere. So what is a Riemann sphere? Riemann sphere is just a complex plane compactified. So I include an infinity as well. Now, what usually is the case that in some cases we can argue based on physics what are the singularities of the function of this type, and in some cases we just have to make a guess. So the assumption here is, that whatever the singularities are, so in this model, again, this is an assumption. And this is something that I cannot prove. And if you wish, this hasn't been proven for this model, is that whatever the function that's relevant there, so the function f of z, is an analytic function around z equal to zero. So the idea is that z equals zero corresponds to small values of the field phi, and so we expect that our model doesn't have pathologies, at least for small values of phi. So in other words, is that our function, so here I have a function f of z, it might have a complicated singularity structure, but I'm sitting around z equal to zero, and the thing is that z equal to zero is not a special point. Again, I cannot argue why this is the case, so the only argument I can give is that we do not expect, So this is a renormal, if you wish, this is a renormalizable field theory. We do our perturbative analysis. By the way, every time you do a perturbative analysis, you are implicitly making this assumption anyway. So, and so the things that we are talking about, I can say I'm talking about, well, I don't want to say that I'm talking about perturbative supersymmetry, because my arguments are more general than that. But there is, that's a very natural assumption, that near the origin of the field space, everything is analytic and nice. So whenever I said this, that my function f of z is analytic around z equal to 0, then, just 1 second, let me write down this. Then this immediately implies this. Where the expansion is over the integer class. Any questions? So what this means that I can write down what my superpotential, what do I expect my superpotential to look like for small values of phi. So, well, I expect it to be, by the way, what I said here implies that there is a finite radius of convergence, right? This is usually what you do not have, what you do not have in your normal non-supersymmetric field theory. In supersymmetric field theories, what happens is that really the singularities are the types that I mentioned. They are typically localized singularities. And this is just a property of the analytic functions. So if I have an analytic function around some point, then the radius of convergence is the distance to the closest nearby singularity. So there will be a finite radius of convergence here. So if I do this, then this tells me that my superpotential will take the following form. So it's times sum, n equals 0 to infinity, f sub n, phi to the n, lambda to the n, m to the minus n. So this equals sum n equals 0 to infinity, f sub n, phi to the n plus 2, lambda to the n, m to the 1 minus n. Well, actually, I already made one assumption, but I didn't have to make it, okay? So the assumptions that I made that I didn't have to make it, in principle, I really didn't care whether my function is analytic or z equals 0. What I needed is that z equals 0 is not a singularity. Okay, so let me make actually a smaller assumption. So the smaller assumption is that phi equals 0, the origin in the field space is not a singular point. That's all I need to do. Phi equals 0 is not a singular point. Okay? So this is a much weaker assumption. Now the only thing that will change now is that instead of a Taylor series expansion, I will have a Laurent expansion. Okay? That's the only thing that will change. So it's a sum from minus infinity to plus infinity. And I'm happy to do that. Okay, so near the origin of the field space, my effective superpotential would have this form, where f sub n are constants. So f sub n are some constants. So in particular, they do not depend on field, they do not depend on costum, they do not depend on mass. And now I'm going to use one of the assumptions that underlines this non-renormalization theorem, is that limit as I turn off the coupling, so those limits are smooth. So in other words, the series that I'm talking about is actually in the limit of vanishing masses and couplings reduces just to a free massless field. So once we make this assumption, notice what happens. The power of this statement is that here I can take this limit any way I want. So what I can do, I can take a limit lambda goes to zero with m kept fixed. Okay, so let me take this limit. So if m kept fixed, and I require that this limit is non-singular. So in order for that limit to be non-singular, I can see that each term contains lambda to the n, and so each term lambda to the n must be non-singular in this limit. So this restricts me that n must be non-negative. And so I have a restriction. What are the possible terms in this Laurent series? And those restrictions tell me that it is actually a Taylor series. It must be a Taylor series expansion. Something that I started before, but as you can see, I need to impose. The second condition is I can take the limit of vanishing couplings in the superprotection by taking m goes to zero with lambda kept fixed. So the way how m enters there is m to the power of 1 minus n. And so the condition that this limit is well defined, so the superpotential is non-singular in this limit, implies that 1 minus n must be larger or equal to 0. Or this implies that m must be less or equal than 1. So we have two conditions. N is larger or equal than 0, and n simultaneously must be less or equal than 1. So this tells me that out of this infinite Laurent series, the only terms that survive are the terms n equals 0 and n equals 1. Okay? Only surviving terms. N equals 0 and n equals 1. There's nothing else. So if n equals to 0, what will I have? I have f0 times phi squared. N equals 0, so I have phi squared. That's the term that will survive. And then there is another term that will survive, f1 times n equals 1, I will have phi cube, and then I have lambda, and there will be no power of that. Okay? So what we arrived to is that if our theory if quantum corrections do not break U1 G across U1 R, and in particular it implies that it will not break SUSY. SUSY is unbroken. Plus, phi equal to 0 is a non-singular point in a field space, then we just derived that any possible quantum corrections must be such that the quantum superpotential, which I call effective, takes this form. But then, the very last step is that in the limit lambda goes to zero, W effective must be equivalent to W microscopic or classical one. So this immediately tells me that F naught equals to 1/2 and F1 equals to 1/3. So what we derived with you is that we started with a microscopic potential which had some numbers, 1/2, 1/3. And what we showed is that under the assumptions that are on that blackboard, the superpotential cannot receive any corrections at all. So all the numbers that enter into it are protected. So this is known as non-minimalization theorem. So we discussed with you a non-minimalization theorem in the context of supersymmetric Bessel minimum. Okay. Yes?
Earlier you said that supersymmetric models are restricted to the supersymmetric model to have renormalizable theorem.
Yeah.
But in this you do not use this. So if you have higher orders,
no.
It's still true.
Yes.
So then it doesn't
from the perspective from the expected field theorem. Yes, because that's the whole reason why I was using here the subscript in fact. And in fact, the statement, the thing is, which in some textbooks show up as a homework assignment, is that, okay, so the homework assignment has two stages. I'm not asking you to do that. I'm just telling you that the reason is that it's almost obvious. You can place it in like that, the one that I said. And you can convince yourself that that's true. So for example, you can generalize the argument that I said is precisely to what you were saying. So there's nothing special about the Bessel model. And in fact, you can look about this, phi plus mu cubed, phi squared, plus mu n, phi to the n, okay? So for large n, it will not be renormalizable. But I can use an argument exactly of this type. So if I say that my field phi, I have global and then the R symmetry. So this one is plus one. And then I have a copy mu m, which has charges minus n, 2 minus n. And then I go ahead and repeat the whole procedure. You can show that W effective is precisely equal to W micro. Okay, so there are no corrections whatsoever. All the coefficients will be the same. So in this case, I choose to normalize it so that those numbers come with coefficient 1. Much like the arguments in the Vesumino model, you can show that the full quantum corrective effective superpotential will not receive any corrections.
Okay, so why don't you pick up extra coupling constants when you start to renormalize in this case? Why can you only say that your new W effective is only dependent on your old coupling constants?
Right, because for example, what you have in mind by asking this question, we looked at the example, for example, of spontaneous symmetry breaking in a column on Weinberg. When we start with lambda phi to the fourth, and there was a spontaneous symmetry generated, there was a spontaneously generated M squared, right? But the M squared was not an independent component. Even though it was generated, it was expressed in terms of lambda. So from this perspective, there are no, even in those models, even though there are new, so the correct thing is to say that there can be new operators which are generated, but there cannot be new couplings.
I see, okay.
And the fact that there are new operators that can be generated is imported in the statement that there is this Laurent series expansion. Because each term in the Laurent series is an operator, right? And what we did, we restricted the possible form of the operators that can arise by requiring that that our superpotential has a smooth limit as the Coppens bench.
Okay. And also, why, like, when we say that phi equals zero is not a singular point,
yeah.
Is there ever a case in which it can be
yes.
A singular point?
Yes.
Then this is under some renormalization scheme that you can, that can be moved?
No. I would say that that's the way to think about this is the following. So phi is a scalar field, right? It has units of mass. Restricting to small values of phi, you can think of as asking the question, what is happening with my model at weak coupling, right? For small values of the field. Now, if your theory is such that low energy behavior is drastically different from the behavior in the UV, right? For example, I have to, somewhere in these arguments, I have to turn off the coupling. And I make the statement that the theory, actually the limit of turning off the coupling is a smooth linear. So it is true in the theories which are free in the infrared. Like, for example, the renormalizable series, lambda phi to the fourth, and series like that. But it is not true in the series which are asymptotically free. So in the asymptotically free series, like a gauge theory, you start with a theory which has a, the series completely different the instant you turn on the coupling. So the loophole here is that you have to make sure that the limit as you turn off the coupling is smooth. For example, if your theory can undergo confinement transition, which is happening in QCD, then the degrees of freedom in the infrared are completely different from the degrees of freedom in the UV. It turns out that there are still a lot you can say, but the thing is that then it becomes crucial that the field that entered in here with phi has nothing to do with the field that was upstairs. In the model that I just mentioned, when we talk about the gauge theory, in the microscopic superpotentials that we will write down that it is a superpotential that depends on the gauge field, and the superpotential that depends on, say, if I have quarks, right? Gauge fields and quarks. Now, if I'm going to write down what is the effect of superpotential at low energies, by the time I go to low energies, I no longer have quarks. And I no longer have gauge fields. I have blue balls, I have mesons, and I have baryons. I can still use this machinery. And the thing that I didn't mention, because but you raised the issue, and so you pretty much forced me to do it, is that before you even start doing that, you have to identify what your low energy degrees of freedom. So in this example, I made an implicit assumption that my low energy degrees, there is no non-trivial dynamics happens as they go from high energy to low energy. So pretty much the same degrees of freedom survive. But if there is a confinement, then there is a complete restructuring. What are my degrees of freedom? And then you have to be careful. For example, in the model that I really want to do it, so maybe at the expense of some topics like spontaneous supersymmetry breaking and some other topics, but I really want to talk about cyber-Quinton model. And in that model, it's an exact example of this type. What you, the origin of the field space, it's exactly relevant to your question. The origin of the field space, the classical origin of this field space, is not the right point on a quantum field space, in quantum field space. And we will, hopefully, if we will do that, we will see why. All right? By the way, here, this is just, again, microscopic superpotential, but you can repeat the same arguments in the context of the full nonlinear sigma model. And so the non-randomization theorem of this type is actually stated as a non-randomization theorem for the full nonlinear sigma model. Okay, very good. So why shouldn't we be on one hand, we should be very excited, because we established the fact that the superpotential doesn't receive quantum corrections. And so in questions, what is the vacuum of our theory, we can answer those questions, including all quantum corrections. However, the issue becomes when we study fluctuations around this vacuum, right? So when we study fluctuations around the vacuum, so superpotential, we know exactly in SUSY quantum field series. So you ask, why cannot we claim that we can solve any supersymmetric quantum field series? And the problem with that is that the Kalle potential, so once we know the superpotential, we know exactly the quantum vacuum. Of the theory, but what we do not know how to study fluctuations. We know, but we have to make an approximation how to study fluctuations. The reason why this question is difficult, because in order for me to study the fluctuations, I need to know kinetic terms for superfields that act as a W effective, and this kinetic term is encoded in a Kalle potential. But the Kalle potential can depend both on chiral superfields and on anti-chiral superfields. So it's neither holomorphic nor anti-holomorphic function. And that's why all this machinery, which heavily relies on properties of holomorphic functions, it just doesn't work. Okay, so it cannot rely on holomorphicity. And so, what will happen is the following. In particular, going back to this example which we just discussed, right? So we started with a classical Lagrangian, and so the classical Lagrangian contained two parts. There was a Kalle potential piece, okay? So which I can actually take a classical Kalle potential, and then there is a superpotential, right? V2 theta. And then here I have 1/2 m phi squared plus 1/3 lambda phi cubed plus Hermitian conjugate. So this was classical. Now once we do an effective, including quantum corrections, so what could happen, d for theta, is that the Kalle potential can receive corrections, and I have absolutely no control of these corrections. So those corrections will be encoded in the wave function renormalization. So this is wave function. Wave function renormalization. And so this wave function renormalization can depend on m and bars, lambda and lambda bars. But this thing does not receive any corrections. Okay. So notice that this statement was exactly the non-perturbative. I didn't have to rely on any perturbations. So here, pretty much the only thing at my disposal to compute the wave function renormalization is to use perturbations here. So I'm back to my standard story as in quantum field theory. Okay. Now the reason why Seibert and Witten has been able to solve any true supersymmetric gauge theory is because in a series where there is, so everything that we talk about is a minimal supersymmetry, right? So we have four supercharges in four dimensions. And the model that Seibert talked about was a theory with eight supersymmetries, Seibert and Witten. And it turns out that in that model, there is a, There is a non-minimalization theorem that includes also a Keller potential. And that's why they have been able to say much more precise things. Okay, so let's see. But nothing is lost, because suppose that this is the case. What I can do, I can actually redefine a new field. Okay? So I can redefine a new field phi hat, which is phi z to the 1/2, okay? And then phi hat log is going to be phi log z to the 1/2. And so now in terms of this new rescaled field, so I explicitly use the fact that Z is a wave function in normalization. My Keller potential, de facto, will take a canonical form, okay? And then my superpotential will get, so their superpotential is not modified if I use the old field. But if I use the correct wave function renormalized field, then the superpotential get modified, okay? And so it will take the following form. So it will take m phi hat squared divided by z, and then I have one third z to the 3/2 lambda phi hat q. You can say that this is much much less useful, because this is much less useful because you don't know what z is, right? So so I don't have any useful information. And in fact, the answer is that's not exactly the case. Because even though there is a wave function in normalization, notice that there can be a particular ratio of the couplings that are protected even though the field phi is renormalized. So what could happen is that certain ratios of couplings can be protected. Protected against quantum corrections. Quantum correction in the Keller potential. So in particular, what I can do, I can take a ratio. Okay, so if I'm going to write down my effective potential, W effective, in this form, F naught phi hat squared, right, plus F1 phi hat cubed. If I'm going to characterize my effective potential in this form, where F0 and F1 are just some couplings, F0 over, let me do it this way. I'm going to do F0 cube, F1 square, classical. I can compute this ratio classically, excluding quantum corrections, right? And so this ratio will give me, well, I have 1/2 m phi squared classically plus 1/3 lambda phi cubed, right? So this ratio classically will give me 1/2 m cubed over 1/3 lambda squared. But I can also compute this ratio quantum mechanically using the effective potential, right? So this is quantum mechanically, including all quantum corrections. And so what I will have 1/2 m over z cubed over 1/3 lambda over z to the 3/2 squared. So what I did, I chose a smart ratio of couplings in such a way that the wave function renormalization simply goes away. So it just drops off. And so this ratio is protected against any corrections. And so this is type of the things that people check when they try to check this non-renormalization theory. You can do loop computation, which involves both the wave function renormalization and coupling constant renormalization in your Lagrangian, and you can check. The supersymmetry predicts that some ratio does not receive any quantum corrections. All right, guys. So something that we will need for the future, and it's a good exercise in the for the class of quantum field theory, but I don't have time to do it in this class. But so it's a perturbative. So I'll just state it as a result. So perturbative. Perturbative computation of Z. So I told you that we don't have control over the wave function renormalization. And so what we need to do, we need to use a perturbation theory. So if we go back and we look at our model, the one that we started, is that in this model, there is U cover interactions. So there is a Yukawa interaction, and this Yukawa interaction is an interaction of this type. I have psi alpha, psi phi, right? So the scalar interacts with a bifermion. And so this lambda that you see there, lambda phi cubed, you can see how this combination will arise. So this is just a, this lambda is the same as a cubic coupling. So for example, the wave function minimalization, I can look by looking at the wave function minimalization of my fermions. And so the kinetic term of the fermions will receive a renormalization from the self-energy diagram, which will be of this type. So I have a propagator. So I have phi bar here, propagator. Okay, and then here I will have psi bar. Okay, and so here I have psi. So I have psi here as well, and I have psi bar here. So this is a cubic vertex, it's lambda. There is a cubic vertex lambda bar here. So there will be a diagram of this type. And you can evaluate this diagram, and the answer is. So this diagram will give you the wave function minimalization. If you want to see how this computation of this type is done, the best reference is, okay, the reference that I use, I'm sorry, I don't know if it is in there. So this is Chen and Li, and so they talk about lambda phi to the fourth quantum field theory. This is a beautiful exercise. You should do, I think it's section two. This is section two there. So they study in detail lambda phi to the fourth m squared phi squared plus lambda phi to the fourth quantum field theory. And they discuss all these aspects, compute some simple diagrams, and that's where, if you haven't seen this before, that's where you have to go and look what is the wave function minimalization and how exactly you compute it. So, so if you do this algebra, you will find out. So this is just the leading order, okay? So the leading order, the wave function minimization, will be proportional to lambda bar. And so much like everything that we discussed in the context of renormalization, when I start talking about renormalization, there can be a running of the couplings. So I have to supply a scale mu at which I am measuring this coupling. And so that scale mu enters in this wave function renormalization, so it enters in this manner. But here, I guess I got to be more specific and emphasize that those are the couplings that are measured at scale mu. And then I have a standard logarithm, so mu divided by m. Okay, where m is the mass of my field. Both my fermions and the scalars will have the same mass. So, and of course there is some number here, and I didn't write down this number. Yeah. What I want to draw your attention, and we all have to understand why the sign is plus. So physically we can understand why it is plus. So we talked about a theory including quantum corrections, and our theory is an effective field theory, right? Meaning that it's valid below some energy scale. So it must be valid below the any scale that we have, roughly any scale we have in the problem. So in particular, our theory makes sense at energies less or equal absolute value of m. M in principle is a complex number. By the way, the phase of this complex number is related to the phase in this Yukawa interaction, so it has its meaning. So our theory is valid in this case, and so what I want to do is I want to look at the limit when I take mass to zero, and I keep my renormalization or subtraction point, subtraction scale or definition at which I this scale mu fixed. Mu is kept fixed. Okay, so I'm just going to look at this limit. What will happen with my theory if I keep everything fixed in my model and I just take the mass to zero? Because the theory is effective, and I'm taking the mass goes to zero, so this is equivalent of looking at the interactions and studying the theory at low energies, right? So this is equivalent to low energy. So this is the equivalent to low energy approximation. Now, if we go to lower energies, we expect so their physical field. The physical field is phi hat, okay? And we expect that the theory is infrared free, right? So one of the things is that as we go from high energies to low energies, we don't expect any drastic reshuffling of the degrees of freedom. So the physical field is phi, and so as we expect, as mu goes to zero, our theory becomes weakly coupled. In terms of the field phi hat. That's our expectation. Now notice that as we take m goes to zero limit, then the wave function normalization. Z to the 1/2 will go to plus, okay? It is Z plus sign. I have the absolute value of coupling squared. And then I have a positive Ln. So Ln of mu that's divided by zero. And so the wave, our wave function randomization goes, becomes infinitely large. It goes to plus infinity, at least to one loop order. But now if that is the case, you can see that, okay, so I think, no, we have it here. So in terms of this phi hat here, the superpotential takes the form. And so in this limit, because the wave function normalization goes to infinity, W effective goes to zero. So we end up with a non-interacting zero. So this is, if you wish, a consistency check, that we are making an assumption that the same degrees of freedom that we use classically, the same degrees of freedom will show up in the effective potential. And if we do things consistently, and consistently meaning trying to, for example, at least do one loop evaluation of the Keller potential, then in the low energy limit, we should end up with the theory of what we think our weakly coupled degrees of freedom to be weakly coupled at precisely zero energy. And that's indeed what's happening there. Very good. So any questions? Okay, so I'm gonna change it. If I have time, I go back to this. So some things that I'm skipping is supersymmetric quad identities. And I can prove you using a supersymmetric quad identities that correlation. Okay, I'm just gonna say it in words, but and if we have time today, I will go back to you. But if we don't have time, then I'm gonna skip there. So the statement is the following. So suppose I look at the correlation function, right? So the endpoint correlation function. It's an expectation value of a field at n points, right? And so, of course, this correlation function, gn, will depend, if I have couplings, so it will depend on the couplings. So what you can do, so we can prove, and the proof is very simple, that this correlation function will depend on couplings only holomorphic. So we can prove that derivatives of the correlation functions of chiral superfields with respect to the anti-holomorphic coupling vanishes. So here are chiral superfields. Okay, so we can rigorously prove this statement using passing integral. And if I have time, I will do that. But if I won't have time today, then we're not going to talk about it. So I want to come to a very important topic, which is moduli space and singularities. And so what I want to do is we want to figure out, so we said that at some stage today, we came to the point, how do we determine this function, right? And we said that it is a holomorphic function, but it might have a singularity. So what we're going to do now, we're going to look at some simple models, and we understand why and how the singularities arise. Because once we know the origin of the singularities, we can use those singularities in order to make predictions about physics. Okay. So our next topic, moduli spaces and singularities. Moduli spaces. All right. So we're going to look at two cases. One is non-generic case, something that's quite rare in supersymmetric model, and the other one that is a more generic case. So case A, this is not generic. So we're going to look at our model, W equals 1/2 k and pi squared plus 1/3 lambda pi cubed. And what we would like to do is we would like to find a space of supersymmetric vector. Find the space of CC vector. Okay? So if you recall from a couple lectures ago, so if W, the superpotential, depends on a bunch of superfields phi, then Susi vacua are determined by vanishing of the F terms. So for each of the superfield, there is a corresponding F term, so F sub I, which is del W over del phi I. And so it must vanish in the vacuum. Okay? So this is true for any I. Okay, and the solution in general will have as many equations as we have fields, and so that will determine for us the possible vector in the model. So in our case, which is a Mezzomino model, things are very simple. So we have a single field, so we have a single F term. Well, actually, to be more precise, it's just F bar. So we have a single field, and so the F-term condition means the vanishing of the derivative. So in our case, it becomes m phi plus lambda phi squared. And so that gives us two vacuum. So W vacuum equals zero and lambda over m. This is there are two possible choices for the expectation value of phi that will lead to a supersymmetric vector. So the important observation, which is a very useful one, is that we have discrete vectors. And actually, in all examples that I know, that's a generic feature, is that if you have discrete vacua, so discrete vacua usually arise from grating of some discrete symmetry. Right. So in this case, we have two vacua. So we expect that there is some hidden. There is some hidden Z2 symmetry in the model that's being broken, okay? And the breaking of this and is being broken by the choice of the vacuum. And so what we would like to do is actually discover this hidden symmetry. We discover the other example, what happens is that if we very similar situation, when we look at the n equal 1 supersymmetric gauge series, if the series is asymptotically free, for example, we take SUN Yang-Mills series, then there will be n minus 1 vacua. There will be a discrete set of vacua. And those vacua are also associated with breaking of some discrete symmetry. So that's why I'm saying that it's actually a general phenomenon whenever you see discrete vacua. And usually what this means is that there is some hidden symmetry that's been broken in this case. In this case, it's very simple to figure out what that symmetry is. So let me show you what that symmetry is. So what I'm going to do in order to make that symmetry explicit, I'm going to shift my field phi. I'm going to redefine phi by saying that it's a constant lambda over 2m plus h. Okay, so h is a new chiral, so this is just a constant. and the H is the U chi algebra. Okay, so it's clear once I did this shift, then my vacuum will be H plus minus, and it will be plus or minus lambda over 2m. So now the symmetry is clear. So the symmetry that I had in mind must be some symmetry that takes the sign of my chiral superfield A. But we can be much more precise. And so all I have to do is to just take the superpotentials that we started with and rewrite it in terms of this new field A. And so when we do the expansion, we will find out this. Again, Jamel would have said, we can use Maple for that, right? I would use Maple. H cubed. Okay? So this is a superpotential. You can see that this is just a constant. A constant doesn't map any superpotential because the superpotential always enter into interactions by integrating over Grassmann variables. So any constant is irrelevant. It will vanish upon integration over Grassmann variables. And so for all purposes, this superpotential is equivalent to this superpotential. So now I'm going to show you what is that two symmetry that that is being broke. Okay, so the symmetry that I have in mind has a generated G, and so this is a generator which will act on Grassmann coordinate theta as follows. So I say that theta goes to high theta, and my chiral superfield it acts as h goes to minus h. So this is the action. This is the action of the global of the discrete symmetry. So a generator So if I do that, d2 theta will go to minus d2 theta. Right? So I have two thetas. And w of h will go to minus w of h, because w is an odd function of h. And so what this means that the integral will be invariant under this discrete symmetry. So I showed you explicitly the discrete symmetry, how it acts. You might wonder, why do I call this a Z2 symmetry? Why Z2 and not Z4? The reason why you might think that it is Z4, because in order, how do I know if I have a free acting group like that, how do I know what the order of that group is? I have to take a generator, and I have to ask, if I multiply that generator, in this case it's a single free generator, how many times, to which power do I have to raise so that the action of that generator is 1? Okay, you will tell me, well, look, why is this G2? Because if I take a square of the generator, the square of the generator acts in this way, and it is only the force power of the generator that is invariant. So naively, it looks like that it is a Z4 group rather than a Z2. So I leave it for you as an exercise to see why it is really a Z2 instead of a Z4. Alright guys, so this case, so I'm going to go now to the next case. So in this case, in this simple Wiesz-Minow model, we see that there is a two discrete vacuum, and we actually discovered that there is a symmetry that is instantaneously broken, and that's the reason why we have two vacuums. In physics, because those two vacuums are related by the discrete symmetry, the physics in each of these vacua is equivalent, so we have an equivalent physics. Now the case, the other case that I'm going to discuss today is much more interesting, and it's a generic situation. So generic case. So this is the case team. So I'm going to look at the model where I have two chiral superfields. So the superpotential takes this form, lambda L h squared. They have some sort of a cubic couplings. Okay, so I'm asking the same question. What are my vacua in this model? So I have del W over del L equals to 1 half lambda h squared of d equals 0. And then I have del W over del H equals to equals to lambda del H must be equal to 0. And so I need to find all possible solutions to this system of equations. So what you can see, that the first equation tells me that H equals to 0. Okay, so the vacuum is when field H is 0. But then L, if I have H equal to 0, then L can be anything. L, so of course here I have to think in terms of the expectation values of these fields, which is something that I should have done in the previous case as well. What I meant by phi, it's an expectation value of the chiral superfield phi. So in this case, the expectation value of L is anything. Okay, and so L is a chiral superfield. The expectation value is parameterized by a complex scalar. And so what we have with you, a one complex dimensional. So we have one complex dimensional space of vacua, which is the same as a one complex dimensional moduli space. Remember, what we call moduli space is the space of all possible supersymmetric vacua in this tree. And so in this case, we have a C1 moduli space. So in the example that we did before, there were discrete vacua, right? So before our discrete vacua, were equivalent. So the physics in those discrete vacua was the same. So what I'm going to show you now is that actually this one complex dimensional moduli space is the space of inequivalent vacuum. So this model has inequivalent vacuum. Okay? So in other words, if you tell me something, and I will tell you in a second what you have to tell me, then I will tell you exactly where on the moduli space you are. I will tell you precisely the expectation value of L. Okay? So something that you need to tell me, what's the spectrum of your theory. What is the small fluctuations? What are the masses of small fluctuations at the point of the vacuum where you are sitting? And once you tell me that, that will determine uniquely the point on the moduli space. Or vice versa, a point on a moduli space leads to it's not correct, as you will see in a second, to say unique, but it leads to a characteristic effect.
So in order for me to show this, what we have to do, we now want to study fluctuations of our chiral superfield on the moduli space. Right? So in order for me to study the fluctuations, I'm going to say that my field has some expectation value, and then I study fluctuations, and the same for L plus X. Okay, so I study it much like we did before. If there is, if some of the fields develop a vacuum expectation value, we shift the fields, and then we study small fluctuations once we shift the fields. In order for this to correspond to a vector, all I have to do, I have to set this to zero. So this is y, and L is anything, so I have to keep it. So then, now my superpotential will become an effective superpotential, right? Because this is a superpotential that will involve these two small fluctuations, x and y. And I can just compute what it will be. And y squared plus, that's it. That's what the effective superpotential for two fields x and y is going to be. And so you can see that it takes the following form. Now let's look what do we have. So what this is, a term in a superpotential which is quadratic in superfields give rise to a mass, right? So this is a mass term. The reason why this is the case, because the potential for scalars will be del W over del phi squared. And so if W has a term which is m phi squared, so this term in the superpotential will correspond to a term in the potential absolute value of m for a scalar component of the chiral. So this is just a mass term. So what we see, just by looking at this superpotential, we see that y is a massive superfield, and in fact, the mass of y squared equals lambda absolute value of L squared. This is what I meant that. You give me the spectrum of the series, I will tell you where on the moduli space you are. So you can see that the mass of the field y depends what the expectation value for the other chiral superfield we have. Notice that the other superfield, x, its masses, is masses. The reason why it is masses, because the superpotential does not contain term which is quadratic in x. There is no term. So there is no term. There is no term of the type x squared times something. Okay. So this piece will be a mass term. A mass term for the x. All right, let me see. I'm thinking where we can wrap it up now. Right, guys, so there are 3 minutes. I don't want to start about metrics on the moduli space because that's an important thing. So what we're going to do next week, we're going to study this model in more detail. We're going to introduce the metrics. So now we know that the moduli space is one complex dimensional. We're going to introduce a metric on this moduli space, and we're going to study the classical metric on the moduli space, and we're going to show that the quantum metric on the moduli space will be singular. And what we will show
notice that something very interesting happens, that this field Y is massless when L equals to 0. What we will show that the quantum moduli space will have a singularity, and the singularity on the moduli space will be precisely when the field Y, which was massive everywhere, will become massless. And that will be a very general situation. If we study supersymmetric series, usually what will happen is that we have big moduli spaces. At some places of this moduli space, there will be a singularity. And so this model will teach us that the physical reason why there is a singularity on the moduli space is because we're missing some massless field. Okay? So, again, missing something, we will talk next week, what does it mean missing something, and in which context.